Yes, and I think that kind of forgetting is easy, which is even more horrible. Jack bent down, picked up the basket, then looked at Wireman. What's in here, gold bars? Wireman grabbed the bag of food and smiled serenely. I packed a few extras. We worked our way up the overgrown driveway, keeping an eye out for the lawn jockey. It did not return. At the top of the porch steps, Jack set the picnic basket down with a little sigh of relief. From behind us came a flurry and flutter of wings. We turned and saw a heron alight on the driveway. It could have been the same one that had been giving me the cold eye from El Palacio's tennis court. Certainly the gaze was the same, blue and sharp and without an ounce of pity. Is that real? Wireman asked. What do you think, Edgar? It's real, I said. How do you know? I could have pointed out that the heron was casting a shadow, but for all I knew, the lawn jockey had been casting one as well. I had been too amazed to notice. I just do. Come on, let's go inside. And don't bother knocking. This isn't a social call. 13. This could be a problem, Jack said. The veranda was deeply shadowed by mats of hanging Spanish moss, but once our eyes had adjusted to the gloom, we could see a thick and rusty chain encircling the double doors. Not one, but two padlocks hung down from it. The chain had been run through hooks on either jamb. Wireman stepped forward for a closer look. You know, he said, Jack and I might be able to snap one or both of those hooks right off. They've seen better days. Better years, Jack said. Maybe, I said, but the doors themselves are almost certainly locked, and if you go rattling chains and snapping hooks, you're going to disturb the neighbors. Neighbors? Wireman asked. I pointed straight up. Wireman and Jack followed my finger and saw what I already had. A large colony of brown bats sleeping in what looked like a vast hanging cloud of cobweb. I glanced down and saw the porch was not just coated but plated with guano. It made me very glad I was wearing a hat. When I looked up again, Jack Cantore was at the foot of the steps. No way, baby, he said. Call me a chicken, call me a candy ass, call me any name in the book. I'm not going there. With Wireman, it's snakes. With me, it's bats. Once, he looked like he had more to say, maybe a lot, but didn't know how to say it. He took another step back instead. I had a moment to contemplate the eccentricity of fear, what the weird jockey hadn't been able to accomplish. Close, but that only counts in horseshoes. A colony of sleeping brown bats had. For Jack, at least. Wireman said, They can carry rabies, muchacho. Did you know that? I nodded. I think we should look for the tradesman's entrance. 14. We made our way slowly along the side of the house, Jack in the lead and carrying the red picnic basket. His shirt was dark with sweat, but he no longer showed the slightest sign of nausea. He should have. Probably we all should have. The stench from the pool was nearly overpowering. Thigh-high grass wickered against our pants. Stiff fiddlewood stems poked at our ankles. There were windows, but unless Jack wanted to try standing on Wireman's shoulders, they were all too high. What time is it? Jack puffed. Time for you to move a little faster, mi amigo, Wireman said. You want me to spell you on that basket? Sure, Jack said, sounding really out of temper for the first time since I'd met him. Then you can have a heart attack, and me and the boss can try out our CPR technique. Are you suggesting I'm not in shape? In shape, but I still put you 50 pounds into the cardiac danger zone. Quit it, I said, both of you. Put it down, son, Wireman said. Put that queso de puta madre down, and I'll carry it the rest of the way. No, forget it. Something black moved in the corner of my eye. I almost didn't look. I thought it was the lawn jockey again, this time darting alongside the pool, or skimming its buggy, smelly surface. Thank God I decided to make sure. Wireman, meanwhile, was glowering at Jack. His manhood had been impugned. I want to spell you. A piece of the pool's turgid nastiness had come alive. It detached itself from the blackness and flopped onto the cracked, weed-sprouting concrete lip, splattering muck about itself in a dirty starburst. No, Wireman, I got it. A piece of nastiness with eyes. Jack, I'm telling you for the last time. Then I saw the tail and realized what I was looking at. And I'm telling you, Wireman, I said and grabbed his shoulder. No, Edgar, I can do this. I can do this. How those words clanged in my head. I forced myself to speak slowly, loudly, and emphatically. Wireman, shut up. There's an alligator. It just came out of the pool. Wireman was afraid of snakes. Jack was afraid of bats. I had no idea I was afraid of alligators until I saw that chunk of prehistoric darkness separate itself from the decaying stew in the old pool and come for us. First across the overgrown concrete, brushing aside the last surviving tipped-over lawn chair as it did, and then sliding into the weeds and vines trailing down from the nearest Brazilian peppers. I caught one glimpse of its snout wrinkling back, one black eye squeezing shut in what could have been a wink, and then there was only its dripping back protruding here and there through the shivering greenery, like a submarine that's three-quarters under. It was coming for us, and after telling Wireman I could do no more, grayness came over my sight. I leaned back against the old warped boards of Heron's Roost. They were warm. I leaned there and waited to be eaten by the 12-foot-long thing that lived in John Eastlake's old swimming pool. Wireman never hesitated. He stripped the red basket from Jack's hands, dropped it on the ground, and knelt beside it, flipping back one end as he did so. He reached inside and produced the largest handgun I had ever seen outside of a motion picture. Kneeling there in the high grass with the open picnic basket in front of him, Wireman gripped it in both hands. I had a good angle on his face, and I thought then and still think now that he looked perfectly serene, especially for a man facing what could be seen as a snake writ large. He waited.
"Shoot it!"
Jack screamed. Wireman waited, and beyond him I saw the heron. It was floating in the air above the long, overgrown utility building behind the tennis court. It was floating upside down. "Wireman," I said, "safety catch?"
"Carai," he murmured and flicked something with his thumb.
A red spot high on the pistol's hand grip winked out of view. He never took his eyes from the high grass, which had now begun to shake. Then it parted, and the alligator came at him. I'd seen them on the Discovery Channel and National Geographic specials, but nothing prepared me for how fast that thing could move on those stub legs. The grass had brushed most of the mud from its rudiment of a face, and I could see its enormous smile.
"Now!"
Jack screamed. Wireman shot. The report was tremendous. It went rolling away like something solid, something made of stone. And the result was tremendous as well. The top half of the alligator's head came off in a cloud of mud, blood, and flesh. It didn't slow down. To the contrary, those stubby legs seemed to speed up as it ran off the last 30 feet or so. I could hear the grass wickering harshly along its plated sides. The barrel of the gun rose with the recoil. Wireman let it. I've never seen calm like that, and it still amazes me. When the gun came back to dead level, the alligator was no more than 15 feet away. He fired again, and the second bullet lifted the thing's front half to the sky, revealing a greenish-white belly. For a moment it seemed to be dancing on its tail, like a happy gator in a Disney cartoon.
"Yeah, you ugly bastard," Jack screamed. "Fuck your mother. Fuck your grandmother."
The gun rose again with the recoil. Once again, Wireman let it. The alligator thumped down on its side, belly exposed, the stubs of its legs thrashing, its tail whipping and tearing up grass and earth in clots. When the muzzle came back level, Wireman pulled the trigger again, and the center of the thing's belly seemed to disintegrate. All at once, the ragged, flattened circle in which it lay was mostly red instead of green. I looked for the heron. The heron was gone. Wireman got up. I saw he was shaking. He walked toward the alligator, although not quite within radius of the still-whipping tail, and pumped two more rounds into it. The tail gave a final convulsive whack against the ground, the body a final jerk, and then it was still. He turned to Jack and held up the automatic in a shaking hand. "Desert Eagle 357, he said. "One big old handgun made by badass Hebrews. James McMurtry, 2006. Mostly what added to the weight of the basket was the ammo.
I tossed in all the clips I had. That was about a dozen. Jack walked over to him, embraced him, then kissed him on both cheeks. I'll carry that basket to Cleveland if you want, and never say a word.
At least you won't have to carry the gun, Wireman said. From now on, sweet old Betsy McCall goes in my belt.
And he put it there, after loading a fresh clip and carefully re-engaging the safety. This took him 2 tries because of his shaking hands. I came over to him and also kissed him on each cheek.
Oh, gosh, he said. Wireman no longer feels Spanish. Wireman is beginning to feel positively French.
How do you happen to have a gun in the first place? I asked.
It was Miss Eastlake's idea, after the last cocaine skirmish in Tampa St. Pete.
He turned to Jack. You remember, don't you?
Yeah, 4 dead.
Anyway, Miss Eastlake suggested I get a gun for home protection. I got a big one. She and I even did some target practice together.
He smiled.
She was good, and she didn't mind the noise, but she hated the recoil.
He looked at the splattered alligator.
I guess it did the job. What next, muchacho?
Around back, but did either of you see that heron?
Jack shook his head, so did Wireman, looking bemused.
I saw it, I told him. And if I see it again, or if either of you do, I want you to shoot it, Jerome.
Wireman raised his eyebrows but said nothing. We resumed our tramp along the east side of the deserted estate. 15. Finding a way in through the back turned out not to be a problem. There was no back. All but the most easterly corner of the mansion had been torn off, probably in the same storm that had taken the top stories. Standing there looking into the overgrown ruin of what had once been a kitchen and pantry, I realized that Heron's Roost was little more than a moss-festooned facade.
"We can get in from here," Jack said doubtfully, "but I'm not sure I trust the floor. What do you think, Edgar?"
"I don't know," I said. I felt very tired. Maybe it was only the spent adrenaline from our encounter with the alligator, but it felt more than that to me. It felt like defeat. There had been too many years, too many storms. And a little girl's drawings were ephemeral things to start with.
What time is it, Wireman?
Without the bullshit, if you please.
He looked at his watch.
2:30. What do you say, muchacho, go in?
I don't know, I repeated.
Well, I do, he said. I killed a fucking alligator to get here. I'm not leaving without at least a look around the old homestead. The pantry floor looks solid, and it's the closest to the ground. Come on, you two, let's pile up some shit to stand on. Couple of those beams should do. Jack, you can go first, then help me. We'll pull Edgar up together.
And that's how we did it, dirty and disheveled and out of breath, scrambling first into the pantry and going from there into the house itself, looking around with wonder, feeling like time travelers, tourists in a world that had ended over 80 years before.
18. Noveen. 1. The house stank of decaying wood, old plaster, and moldy fabric. There was also an underlying greenish odor. Some of the furniture was left, ruined by time and slumped by moisture. But the fine old wallpaper in the parlor hung in strips, and there was a huge paper nest, ancient and silent, clinging to the ceiling in the rotting front hall. Below it, dead wasps lay in a foot-deep hill, on the warped cypress floorboards. Somewhere, in what remained of the upstairs, water was dripping, one isolated drop at a time.
The cypress and the redwood in this place would have been worth a fortune if somebody had come up and got it before it went to hell, Jack said.
He bent down, seized the end of a protruding board, and pulled. It came up, bent almost like taffy, then broke off, not with a snap, but with a listless crump. A few woodlice came strolling from the rectangular hole below it. The smell that puffed up was dank and dark.
"No scavenge, no salvage, and nobody up here partying hardy," Wireman said. "No discarded condoms or step-ins. Not a single Joe Loves Debbie spray painted on the wall. I don't think anyone's been up here since John chained the door and drove away for the last time. I know that's hard to believe."
"No," I said, "it's not. The heron's roost at this end of the quay has belonged to Percy since 1927. John knew it, and made sure to keep it that way when he wrote his will. Elizabeth did the same,
but it's not a shrine. I looked into the room opposite the formal parlor. It might once have been a study. An old roll-top desk sat in a puddle of stinking water. There were bookshelves, but they stood empty. It's a tomb. So where do we look for these drawings? Jack asked. I have no idea, I said. I don't even... A chunk of plaster lay in the doorway, and I kicked it. I wanted to send it flying, but it was too old and wet and only disintegrated. I don't think there are any more drawings. Not now that I see the place. I glanced around again, smelling the wet reek. You could be right, but I don't trust you, Wireman said. Because, muchacho, you're in mourning, and that makes a man tired. You're listening to the voice of experience. Jack went into the study, squishing across damp boards to get to the old roll top. A drop of water plinked down on the visor of his cap, and he looked up. Ceiling's caving in, he said. There was probably at least one bathroom overhead, maybe two, and maybe a roof cistern to catch rainwater back in the day. I can see a hanging pipe. One of these years it's going to come all the way down, and this desk will go bye-bye. Just make sure you don't go bye-bye, Jack, Wireman said. It's the floor I'm worried about right now, he said. Feels mushy as hell. Come back, then, I said. In a minute, let me check this first. He ran the drawers one after the other. Nothing, he said. Nothing. More nothing. Nothing. He paused. Here's something. A note. Handwritten. Let's see it, Wireman said. Jack brought it to him, taking big, careful steps until he got past the wet part of the floor. I read over Wireman's shoulder. The note was scrawled on plain white paper in a big, flat man's hand. August 19, 26. Johnny, you want, you get. This is the last of the good stuff, and just for you, my lad. The Champers ain't my best ever, but what the hell. Single malt's okay, CC for the common herd, ha-ha. 5 can in the keg. And as you asked, table times 2. And in Sarah. I take no credit, just struck lucky. But it really is the last. Thanks for everything, pal. See you when I get back this side of the puddle. D.D. Wireman touched table times 2 and said, The table is leaking. Does the rest of this mean anything to you, Edgar? It did, but for a moment my damn sick memory refused to give it up. I can do this, I thought, and then thought sideways. First to Ilsa saying, Share your pool, mister? And that hurt, but I let it because that was the way in. What followed was the memory of another girl dressed for another pool. This girl was all breasts and long legs in a black tank suit. She was Mary Eyre as Hockney had painted her, Gidget and Tampa, she had called her younger self. Then I had it. I let out a breath I hadn't known I was holding. D.D. was Dave Davis, I said. In the roaring 20s, he was a Suncoast mogul. How do you know that? Mary Eyre told me, I said, and a cold part of me that would probably never warm up again could appreciate the irony. Life is a wheel, and if you wait long enough, it always comes back around to where it started. Davis was friends with John Eastlake and apparently supplied Eastlake with plenty of good liquor. Champers, Jack said. That's champagne, right? Wireman said, Good for you, Jack, but I want to know what table is. And Sarah. It's Spanish, Jack said. You should know that. Wireman cocked an eyebrow at him. You're thinking of Sarah with an S, as in Que Sera Sera. Doris Day, 1956, I said. The future's not ours to see. And a good thing, too, I thought. One thing I'm pretty sure of is that Davis was right when he said this was the last delivery. I tapped the date, August 19th. The guy sailed for Europe in October of 1926 and never came back. He disappeared at sea, or so Mary Eyre told me. And Sarah? Wireman asked. Let it go for now, I said. But it's strange. Just this one piece of paper. A little odd, maybe, but not completely strange, Wireman said. If you were a widower with young daughters, would you want to take your bootlegger's last receipt with you into your new life? I considered it and decided he had a point. No, but I'd probably destroy it along with my stash of French postcards. Wireman shrugged.
We'll never know how much incriminating paperwork he did destroy, or how little. Except for having a little drinking now and then with his pals, his hands may have been relatively clean, but muchacho. He put a hand on my shoulder. The paper is real. We do have it. And if something's out to get us, maybe something else is looking out for us. Just a little. Isn't that possible? It would be nice to think so, anyway. Let's see if there's anything else. 2. It seemed at first there wasn't. We poked around all the downstairs rooms and found nothing but near disaster when my foot plunged through the flooring in what must once have been the dining room. Wireman and Jack were quick, however, and at least it was my bad leg that went down. I had my good one to brace myself with. There was no hope of checking above ground level. The staircase went all the way up, but beyond the landing and the single ragged length of rail beside it, there was only blue sky and the waving fronds of one tall cabbage palm. The second floor was a remnant, the third complete toast. We started back toward the kitchen and our makeshift step down to the outside world, with nothing to show for our exploration but an ancient note announcing a booze delivery. I had an idea what Sarah might mean, but without knowing where Percy was, the idea was useless. And she was here. She was close. Why else make it so fucking hard to get here? Wireman was in the lead, and he stopped so suddenly I ran into him. Jack ran into me, whacking me in the butt with the picnic basket. "We need to check the stairs," Wireman said. He spoke in the tone of a man who can't believe he has been such a dumb cluck. "I beg pardon?" I asked. "We need to check the stairs for a ha-ha. I should have thought of that first thing. I must be losing it." "What's a ha-ha?" I asked. Wireman was turning back. "The one at El Palacio is 4 steps up from the bottom of the main staircase. The idea, she said it was her father's, was to have it close to the front door in case of fire. There's a lockbox inside it, and nothing much inside the lockbox now but a few old souvenirs and some pictures. But once she kept her will and her best pieces of jewelry in there. Then she told her lawyer, big mistake. He insisted she move all that stuff to a safe deposit box in Sarasota." We were at the foot of the stairs now, back near the hill of dead wasps. The stink of the house was thick around us. He turned to me, his eyes gleaming. "Muchacho, she also kept a few very valuable china figures in that box." He surveyed the wreck of the staircase, leading up to nothing but senseless shattery and blue sky beyond. "You don't suppose, if Percy is something like a china figure that John fished off the bottom of the gulf, you don't suppose she's hidden right here in the stairs?" "I think anything's possible. Be careful. Very." "I'll bet you anything that there's a ha-ha," he said. "We repeat what we learn as children." He brushed away the dead wasps with his boot. They made a whispery, papery sound, and then knelt at the foot of the stairs. He examined the first stair riser, then the second, then the third. When he got to the fourth, he said, "Jack, give me the flashlight." 3. It was easy to tell myself that Percy wasn't hiding in a secret compartment under the stairs. That would be too easy. But I remembered the chinas Elizabeth liked to secrete in her sweet Owen cookie tin and felt my pulse speed up as Jack rummaged in the picnic basket and brought out the monster flashlight with the stainless steel barrel. He slapped it into Wireman's hand like a nurse handing a doctor an instrument at the operating table. When Wireman trained the light on the stair, I saw the minute gleam of gold, tiny hinges set at the far end of the tread. "Okay," he said and handed back the flashlight. "Put the beam on the edge of the tread." Jack did as he was told. Wireman reached for the lip of the riser, which was meant to swing up on those tiny hinges. "Wireman, just a minute," I said. He turned to me. "Sniff it first," I said.
"Say what?"
"Sniff it. Tell me if it smells wet." He sniffed the stair with the hinges at the back, then turned to me again.
"A little damp, maybe, but everything in here smells that way. Want to be a little more specific?"
"Just open it very slowly, okay? Jack, shine the light directly inside. Look for wetness, both of you."
"Why, Edgar?"
Jack asked.
Because the table is leaking, she said so. If you see a ceramic container, a bottle, a jug, a keg, that's her. It'll almost certainly be cracked, and maybe broken wide open.
Wireman pulled in a breath, then let it out. Okay. As the mathematician said when he divided by zero, here goes nothing. He tried to lift the stair with no result. It's locked. I see a tiny slot. Must have been a hell of a small key.
I've got a Swiss Army knife, Jack offered.
Just a minute, Wireman said, and I saw his lips tighten down as he applied upward pressure with his fingertips. A vein stood out in the hollow of his temple.
Wireman, I started, be careful. Before I could finish, the lock, old and tiny and undoubtedly rotten with rust, snapped. The stair tread flew up and tore off at the hinges.
Wireman tumbled backwards, Jack caught him, and then I caught Jack in a clumsy, one-armed hug. The big flashlight hit the floor but didn't break. Its bright beam rolled, spotlighting that grisly pile of dead wasps.
Holy shit, Wireman said, regaining his feet. Larry, Curly, and Moe.
Jack picked up the flashlight and shone it into the hole in the stairs.
What?
I asked.
Anything?
Nothing?
Talk.
Something, but it's not a ceramic bottle, he said. It's a metal box. Looks like a candy box, only bigger.
He bent down.
Maybe you better not, Wireman said. But it was too late for that. Jack reached in all the way up to his elbow, and for one moment I was sure his face would lengthen in a scream as something battened on his arm and yanked him down to the shoulder. Then he straightened again. In his hand he held a heart-shaped tin box. He held it out to us. On the top, barely visible, beneath speckles of rust, was a pink-cheeked angel. Below that, in old-fashioned script, these painted words. Elizabeth. Her things. Jack looked at us questioningly.
Go on, I said.
It wasn't Percy. I was positive of that now. I felt both disappointed and relieved.
You found it. Go on and open it.
It's the drawings, Wireman said.
It must be.
I thought so too, but it wasn't. What Jack lifted out of the rusty old heart-shaped box was Libet's dolly, and seeing Noveen was like coming home.
Oh, her black eyes and scarlet smiling mouth seemed to be saying, oh, I've been in here all that time, you nasty man.
4. When I saw her come out of that box like a disinterred corpse out of a crypt, I felt a terrible, helpless horror come stealing through me, beginning at the heart and radiating outward, threatening to first loosen all my muscles and then unknit them completely.
Edgar?
Wireman asked sharply. All right? I did my best to get hold of myself. Mostly it was the thing's toothless smile. Like the jockey's cap, that smile was red. And as with the jockey's cap, I felt that if I looked at it too long, it would drive me mad. That smile seemed to insist that everything which had happened in my new life was a dream I was having in some hospital ICU, while machines kept my twisted body alive a little while longer. And maybe that was good, for the best, because it meant nothing had happened to Ilsa.
Edgar?
When Jack stepped toward me, the doll in his hand bobbed in its own grotesque parody of concern.
You're not going to faint, are you?
No, I said. Let me see that. And when he tried to pass it to me, I don't want to take it, just hold it up. He did as I asked, and I understood at once why I'd had that feeling of instant recognition, that sense of coming home. Not because of Reba or her more recent companion, although all three were rag dolls, there was that similarity. No, it was because I had seen her before, in several of Elizabeth's drawings. At first I'd assumed she was Nan Melda. That was wrong, but...
Nan Melda gave this to her, I said.
Sure, Wireman agreed, and it must have been her favorite, because it was the only one she ever drew. The question is, why did she leave it behind when the family left Heron's Roost? Why did she lock it away?
Sometimes dolls fall out of favor, I said.
I was looking at that red and smiling mouth, still red after all these years, red like the place memories went to hide when you were wounded and couldn't think straight. Sometimes dolls get scary.
Her pictures talk to you, Edgar, Wireman said.
He waggled the doll and then handed it to Jack.
What about her? Will the doll tell you what we want to know?
Noveen, I said. Her name's Noveen, and I wish I could say yes, but only Elizabeth's pencils and pictures speak to me.
How do you know?
A good question. How did I know?
I just do. I bet she could have talked to you, Wireman, before I fixed you, when you still had that little twinkle.
Too late now, Wireman said.
He rummaged in the food stash, found the cucumber strips, and ate a couple.
So what do? Go back? Because I have an idea that if we go back, Chacho, we'll never summon the testicular fortitude to return.
I thought he was right, and meanwhile the afternoon was passing all around us. Jack was sitting on the stairs, his butt on a riser 2 or 3 above the ha-ha. He was holding the doll on his knee. Sunshine fell through the shattered top of the house and dusted them with light. They were strangely evocative, would have made a terrific painting, young man and doll. The way he was holding Naveen reminded me of something, but I couldn't put my finger on just what. Naveen's black shoe-button eyes seemed to look at me, almost smugly. I seen a lot, you nasty man. I seen it all. I know it all. Too bad I'm not a picture you can touch with your phantom hand, ain't it?
Yes, it was.
There was a time when I could have made her talk, Jack said.
Wireman looked puzzled, but I felt that little click you get when a connection you've been trying to make finally goes through.
Now I knew why the way he was holding the doll looked so familiar.
Into ventriloquism, were you?
I hoped I sounded casual, but my heart was starting to bump against my ribs again. I had an idea that here at the south end of Duma Key, many things were possible, even in broad daylight.
Yeah, Jack said with a smile that was half embarrassed, half reminiscent. I bought a book about it when I was only 8, and stuck with it mostly because my dad said it was like throwing money away. I gave up on everything.
He shrugged, and Noveen bobbed a bit on his leg, as if she were also trying to shrug.
I never got great at it, but I got good enough to win the 6th grade talent competition.
My dad hung the medal on his office wall. That meant a lot to me.
Yeah, Wireman said. There's nothing like an attaboy from a doubtful dad.
Jack smiled, and as always, it illuminated his whole face. He shifted a little, and Noveen shifted with him.
Best thing, though, I was a shy kid, and ventriloquism broke me out a little. It got easier to talk to people. I'd sort of pretend I was Morton, my dummy, you know? Morton was a wise-ass who'd say anything to anybody.
They all are, I said. It's a rule, I think.
Then I got into junior high, and ventriloquism started to seem like a nerd talent compared to skateboarding, so I gave it up. I don't know what happened to the book. Throw Your Voice, it was called.
We were silent. The house breathed dankly around us. A little while ago, Wireman had killed a charging alligator. I could hardly believe that now, even though my ears were still ringing from the gunshots.
Then Wireman said, I want to hear you do it. Make her say, Buenos dias, amigos, mi nombre es Noveen. And la mesa is leaking.
Jack laughed.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm serious.
I can't. If you don't do it for a while, you forget how.
And from my own research, I knew he could be right. In the matter of learned skills, memory comes to a fork in the road. Down one branch are the it's-like-riding-a-bicycle skills, things which once learned are almost never forgotten. But the creative, ever-changing forebrain skills have to be practiced almost daily, and they are easily damaged or destroyed. Jack was saying ventriloquism was like that. And while I had no reason to doubt him, it involved creating a new personality, after all, as well as throwing one's voice. I said, give it a try.
What?
He looked at me smiling, puzzled.
Go on, take a shot.
I told you, I can't.
Try anyway.
Edgar, I have no idea what she would sound like, even if I could still throw my voice.
Yeah, but you've got her on your knee, and it's just us chickens, so go ahead.
Well, shit.
He blew his hair off his forehead.
What do you want her to say?
Wireman said, very quietly indeed, why don't we just see what comes out?
5.
Jack sat with Noveen on his knee for a moment longer. Their heads in the sun, little bits of disturbed dust from the stairs and the ancient hall carpet floating around their faces. Then he shifted his grip so that his fingers were on the doll's rudiment of a neck and her cloth shoulders. Her head came up. "Hello, boys," Jack said, only he was trying not to move his lips, and it came out, "Hello, oys." He shook his head. The disturbed dust flew. "Wait a minute," he said. "That sucks." "Got all the time in the world," I told him. I think I sounded calm, but my heart was thudding harder than ever. Part of what I was feeling was fear for Jack. If this worked, it might be dangerous for him. He stretched out his throat and used his free hand to massage his Adam's apple. He looked like a tenor getting ready to sing, or like a bird, I thought. A gospel hummingbird, maybe. Then he said, "Hello, boys." It was better, but no, he said, "shit on toast. Sounds like that old blonde chick, Mae West. Wait." He massaged his throat again. He was looking up into the cascading bright as he did it, and I'm not sure he knew that his other hand, the one on the doll, was moving. Noveen looked first at me, then at Wireman, then back at me. Black shoe-button eyes. Black beribboned hair cascading around a chocolate cookie face. Red O of a mouth. An O, you nasty man mouth, if ever there was one. Wireman's hand gripped mine. It was cold. "Hello, boys," Noveen said. And although Jack's Adam's apple bobbed up and down, his lips barely moved on the B at all. "Hey, how was that?"
"Good,"
Wireman said, sounding as calm as I didn't feel. "Have her say something else." "I get paid extra for this, don't I, boss?"
"Sure," I said. "Time and a..."
"Ain't you gonna draw nothing?"
Noveen asked, looking at me with those round black eyes. They really were shoe buttons, I was almost sure of it. "I have nothing to draw," I said. "Noveen,
I'll tell you something you can draw. Where at your pad?"
Jack was now looking off to the side, into the shadows leading to the ruined parlor, bemused, eyes distant. He looked neither conscious nor unconscious. He looked someplace between. Wireman let go of me and reached into the food bag where he had stowed the two artisan pads. He handed me one. Jack's hand flexed a bit, and Noveen appeared to bend her head slightly to study it, as I first flipped back the cover and then unzipped the pouch that held my pencils. I took one.
"No, no. Use one of hers."
I rummaged again and took out Libet's pale green. It was the only one still long enough to afford a decent grip. It must not have been her favorite color. Or maybe it was just that Duma's greens were darker. "All right. Now what?"
"Draw me in the kitchen. Put me up again in the bread box. That'd do fine."
"On the counter, do you mean? Think I was talking about on the floor?"
"Christ," Wireman muttered.
The voice had been changing steadily with each exchange. Now it wasn't Jack's at all. And whose was it, given the fact that in its prime the only ventriloquism available to make the doll speak had been provided by a little girl's imagination? I thought it had been Nan Melda's then, and that we were listening to a version of that voice now. As soon as I began to work, the itch swept down my missing arm, defining it, making it there. I sketched her sitting against an old-fashioned bread box, then drew her legs dangling over the edge of the counter. With no pause or hesitation, something deep inside me, where the pictures came from, said that to hesitate would be to break the spell while it was still forming, while it was still fragile. I went on and drew the little girl standing beside the counter. Standing beside the counter and looking up. Little 4-year-old girl in a pinafore. I could not have told you what a pinafore was before I drew one over little Libet's dress as she stood there in the kitchen beside her doll. As she stood there looking up. As she stood there. Shh. With one finger to her lips. Now moving quicker than ever, the pencil racing, I added Nan Melda. Seeing her for the first time outside that photograph where she was holding the red picnic basket bunched in her arms. Nan Melda bent over the little girl, her face set and angry. No, not angry. 6. Scared. That's what Nan Melda is. scared near to death. She knows something is going on. Libet knows something is going on, and the twins know it too. Tessie and Lolo are as scared as she is. Even that fool Shannington knows something's wrong. That's why he's taken to staying away as much as he can, preferring to work on the farm shoreside instead of coming out to the quay. And the mister? When he's here, the mister's too mad about Addie, who's run off to Atlanta to see what's right in front of his eyes. At first, Nan Melda thought what was in front of her eyes was just her own imagination, picking up on the Babian's games. Surely she never really saw no pelicans or herons flying upside down, or the horses smiling at her when Shannington brought over the two team from Nokomis to give the girls a ride. And she guessed she knew why the little ones were scared of Charlie. There might be mysteries on Duma now, but that ain't one of them. That was her own fault, although she meant well. 7. Charlie, I said. His name's Charlie. Naveen cawed her laughing assent. I took the other pad out of the food sack, almost ripped it out, and threw back the cover so savagely that I tore it half off. I groped among the pencils and found a stub of Libet's black. I wanted black for this side drawing, and there was just enough to pinch between my thumb and finger. Edgar, Wireman said. For a minute there, I thought I saw... It looked like... Shut up, Naveen cried. Never mind no mojo arm. You're gonna want to see this, I bet. I drew quickly, and the jockey came out of the white like a figure out of heavy fog. It was quick, the strokes careless and hurried, but the essence was there. The knowing eyes and the broad lips that might have been grinning with either mirth or malevolence. I had no time to color the shirt and the breeches, but I fumbled for the pencil stamped plain red, one of mine, along its barrel, and added the awful cap, scribbling it in. And once the cap was there, you knew what that grin really was. A nightmare. Show me, Naveen cried. I want to see if you got it right. I held the picture up to the doll, who now sat straight on Jack's leg while Jack slumped against the wall beside the staircase, looking off into the parlor. Yep, Naveen said. That's the bugger who scared Melda's girls, most certainly. What? Wireman began and shook his head. I'm lost. Melda seen the frog, too, Naveen said. The one the babbies called a big boy. The one with the teeth. That's when Melda finally cornered Libet in the kitchen to make her talk. At first, Melda thought the stuff about Charlie was just little kids scaring each other, didn't she? Naveen cawed again, but her shoe-button eyes stared with what could have been horror. Of course, eyes like that can look like anything you want them to, can't they? That's right, sugar. But when she seen old big boy down there at the foot of the lawn, crossing the driveway and going into the trees. Jack's hand flexed. Naveen's head shook slowly back and forth, indicating the collapse of Nan Melda's defenses. I shuffled the pad with Charlie and a jockey on it to the bottom and went back to the picture of the kitchen, Nan Melda looking down, the little girl looking up with her finger on her lips, shh, and the doll bearing silent witness from her place against the bread box. Do you see it? I asked Wireman. Do you understand? Sort of. Sugar candy was mostly done once she was out, Naveen said. That's what it come down to. Maybe at first Melda thought Shannington was moving the lawn jockey around as kind of a joke, because he knew the three little girls were scared of it. Why in God's name would they be? Wireman asked. Naveen said nothing, so I passed my missing hand over the Naveen in my drawing. The Naveen leaning against the bread box, and then the one on Jack's knee spoke up, as I sort of knew she would. Nanny didn't mean nothing bad. She knew they were scared of Charlie. This was before the bad thing started, and so she told him a bedtime story to try and make it better. Made it worse instead, as sometimes happens with small children. Then the bad woman come, the bad white woman from the sea, and that bitch made it worse still. She made Libet draw Charlie alive for a joke. She had other jokes, too. I threw back the sheet with Libet going shh, seized my burnt umber from my pack, now it didn't seem to matter whose pencils I used, and sketched the kitchen again. Here was the table with Naveen lying on her side, one arm cast up over her head as if in supplication. Here was Libet now wearing a sundress and an expression of dismay achieved in no more than half-dozen racing lines. And here was Nan Melda, backing away from the open bread box and screaming because inside... "Is that a rat?" Wireman asked. "Big old blind woodchuck," Noveen said. "Same thing as Charlie, really. She got Libet to draw it in the bread box, and it was in the bread box. A joke. Libet is sorry, but the bad water woman? Nuh-uh. She never sorry. And Elizabeth, Libet, had to draw," I said, "didn't she?" "You know that," Noveen said. "Don't you?" I did, because the gift is hungry. 8. Once upon a time, a little girl fell and did her head wrong in just the right way. And that allowed something, something female, to reach out and make contact with her. The amazing drawings that followed had been the come-on, the carrot dangling at the end of the stick. There had been smiling horses and troops of rainbow-colored frogs. But once Percy was out, what had Noveen said? Sugar candy was mostly done. Libet Eastlake's talent had turned in her hand like a knife. Except it was no longer really her hand. Her father didn't know. Addie was gone. Maria and Hannah were away at the Braden School. The twins couldn't understand. But Nan Melda began to suspect, and... I flipped back and looked at the little girl with the finger on her lips. "She's listening, so shh. If you talk, she'll hear, so shh. Bad things can happen, and worse things are waiting. Terrible things in the Gulf waiting to drown you and take you to a ship where you'll live something that's not life. And if I try to tell, then the bad things may happen to all of us, and all at once." Wireman was perfectly still beside me. Only his eyes moved, sometimes looking at Noveen, sometimes looking at the pallid arm that flickered in and out of view on the right side of my body. "But there was a safe place, wasn't there?" I asked. "A place where she could talk." "Where?" "You know," Naveen said. "No, I..." "Yes, sir, you do, you sure do. You only forgot a while. Draw it and you see." Yes, she was right. Drawing was how I'd reinvented myself. In that way, Libet, where our sister, was my kin. For both of us, drawing was how we remembered how to remember. I flipped to a clean sheet. "Do I have to use one of her pencils?" I asked. "Not no more, you'd be fine with any." So I rummaged around in my pack, found my indigo, and began drawing. I drew the Eastlake swimming pool with no hesitation. It was like giving up thought and allowing muscle memory to punch in a phone number. I drew it as it had been when it had been bright and new and full of clean water. The pool, where for some reason Percy's hold slipped and her hearing failed. I drew Nan Melda up to her shins and Libet up to her waist, with Noveen tucked under her arm, and her pinafore floating around her. Words floated out of my strokes. "Wear your new doll now, the China doll." "In my special treasure box, my heart box." So it had been there, at least for a while. "And what her name?" "Her name is Percy. Percy, a boy's name." And Libet, firm and sure. "I can't help it, her name is Percy." "All right, then. And you say she can't hear us here?" "I don't think so." "That's good. You say you can make things come, but listen to me, child." 9. "Oh, my God," I said. "It wasn't Elizabeth's idea. It was never Elizabeth's idea. We should have known." I looked up from the picture I had drawn of Nan Melda and Libet standing in the pool. I realized in a distant way that I was very hungry. "What are you talking about, Edgar?" Wireman asked. Getting rid of Percy was Nan Melda's idea. I turned to Noveen, still sitting on Jack's knee. "I'm right, aren't I?" Noveen said nothing, so I passed my right hand over the figures in my swimming pool drawing. For a moment I saw that hand, long fingernails and all. Nanny didn't know no better, Noveen said an instant later from Jack's leg. "And Libet be trusting Nanny." "Of course she did," Wireman said. "Melda was almost the child's mother." I had visualized the drawing and erasing as happening in Elizabeth's room, but now I knew better. It had happened at the pool. Perhaps even in the pool. because the pool had been, for some reason, safe, or so little Libet believed. Naveen said, "It didn't make Percy gone, but it surely did get her attention. I think it hurt that bitch." The voice sounded tired now, croaky, and I could see Jack's Adam's apple sliding up and down in his throat again. "I hope it did." "Yes," I said. "Probably it did. So, what came next?" But I knew, not the details, but I knew. The logic was grim and irrefutable. Percy took her revenge on the twins, and Elizabeth and Nan Melda knew. They knew what they did. Nan Melda knew what she did. "She knew," Naveen said. It was still a female voice, but it was edging closer to Jack's all the time. Whatever the spell was, it wouldn't hold much longer. She held on until Mister found their tracks down on Shade Beach. Tracks going into the water. But after that, she couldn't hold on no longer. She felt she got her babians killed. "Did she see the ship?" I asked. "Seen it that night. You can't see that boat at night and not believe." I thought of my girl and ship paintings and knew that was the truth. But even before the mister rung up the high sheriff on the exchange to say his twins was missing and probably drowned, Percy done spoke to Libet. Told her how it was. And Libet told Nanny. The doll slumped, its round cookie face seeming to study the heart-shaped box from which it had been exhumed. "Told her what, Naveen?" Wireman asked. "I don't understand." Naveen said nothing. Jack, I thought, looked exhausted, even though he hadn't moved at all. I answered for Naveen. "Percy said, try to get rid of me again and the twins are just the beginning. Try again and I'll take your whole family one by one and save you for last. Isn't that right?" Jack's fingers flexed. Naveen's rag head nodded slowly up and down. Wireman licked his lips. "That doll," he said. "Exactly whose ghost is it?" "There are no ghosts here, Wireman," I said. Jack moaned. "I don't know what he's been doing, amigo, but he's done," Wireman said. "Yes, but we're not." I reached for the doll, the one that had gone everywhere with the child artist. And as I did, Naveen spoke to me for the last time, in a voice that was half hers and half Jack's, as if both of them were struggling to come through at the same time. "Nuh-uh, not that hand. You need that hand to draw with." And so I reached out the arm I used to lift Monica Goldstein's dying dog out of the street 6 months ago, in another life and universe. I used that hand to grasp Elizabeth Eastlake's doll and lift it off Jack's knee. "Edgar," Jack said, straightening up. "Edgar, how in hell did you get your..." "Arm back, I suppose," he said, "but I don't know for sure. I didn't hear the finish. What I saw were those black eyes and that black maw of a mouth ringed with red. Naveen. All these years she had been down there in the double dark, under the stair in the tin box, waiting to spill her secrets, and her lipstick had stayed fresh all the while. "Are you set?" she whispered inside my head, and that voice wasn't Naveen's, wasn't Nan Melda's. I was sure of that, wasn't even Elizabeth's. That was all Reba. "You all set and ready to draw, you nasty man? Are you ready to see the rest? Are you ready to see it all?" I wasn't, but I would have to be. For Ilsa. "Show me your pictures," I whispered. And that red mouth swallowed me whole. How to Draw a Picture. 10. Be prepared to see it all. If you want to create, God help you if you do. God help you if you can. Don't you dare commit the immorality of stopping on the surface. Go deep and take your fair salvage. Do it no matter how much it hurts. You can draw two little girls, twins, but anyone can do that. Don't stop there just because the rest is a nightmare. Do not neglect to add the fact that they're standing thigh-deep in water that should be over their heads. A witness, Emery Paulson, for instance, could see this if he looked. But so many people aren't prepared to see what is right in front of their eyes. Until, of course, it's too late. He's come down to the beach to smoke a cigar. He can do this on the back porch or on the veranda, but some strong compulsion has urged him down the rutted road Addie calls Drunkard's Boulevard, and then down the steeper sandy path to the beach. This voice has suggested his cigar will taste better here. He can sit on a fallen log the waves have cast up and watch the after ashes of the sunset, as orange fades to tangerine and the stars go blue. The Gulf will look pleasant in such light, the voice suggests, even if the Gulf has had the bad taste to mark the beginning of his marriage by swallowing two of his beloved's little sisters. But there's more to watch than just a sunset, it seems. There's a ship out there. It's an old-fashioned one, a pretty, slim-hulled thing with three masts and furled sails. Instead of sitting on the log, he walks down the beach to where the dry sand becomes wet and firm and packed, marveling at that swallow shape against the fading sunset. Some trick of the air makes it seem as if the day's last red is shining right through the hull. He's thinking this is when the first cry comes, chiming in his head like a silver bell. Emery! And then comes another. Emery! Help! The undertow! The rip! That is when he sees the girls, and his heart gives a springing leap. It seems to rise all the way to his throat before falling back into place, where it dashes double time. The unlit cigar tumbles from his fingers. Two little girls, and they look just the same. They appear to be wearing identical jumpers, and although Emery should not be able to distinguish colors in this dying light, he can. One jumper is red with an L on the front, the other is blue with a T. The rip! The girl with the T on her jumper calls, holding out her arms in supplication. The undertow, calls the girl with the L. And although neither girl appears to be in the slightest danger of drowning, Emery doesn't hesitate. His joy won't let him hesitate, nor his bright certainty that this is a miracle opportunity. When he turns up with the twins, his previously distant father-in-law will change his tune in a hurry. And the silver chimes those voices ring in his head, they urge him forward, too. He rushes to rescue Addie's sisters, to gather the lost girls in and splash with them to shore. Emery! That's Tessie, her eyes dark in her china-pale face, but her lips are red. Emery, hurry! That's Laura, with her dripping white hands held out to him and her lank curls pasted against her white cheeks. He cries, I'm coming, girls, hold on! Splashing toward them, now up to his shins, now his knees. He cries, fight it! As though they are doing anything but standing there in water that is only thigh deep on them. Although he's now up to his own thighs, and he's 6 feet and 2 inches tall. The water of the Gulf, still chilly in mid-April, is up to his chest when he reaches them. When he reaches out to them. And when they seize him with hands that are stronger than any little girl's hands should be. By the time he's close enough to see the silvery gleam in their glazed eyes and smell the salty, dead fish aroma coming from their rotting hair, it's too late. He struggles, his cries of joy and his entreaties to fight the undertow turning first to yells of protest and then to screams of horror, but by then it's far too late. The screams do not last long in any case. Their small hands have become cold claws digging deep into his flesh as they pull him deeper. And the water fills his mouth, drowning his screams. He sees the ship against the last cold ashes of the sunset. And how did he not see it before? How did he not know? Realizes it is a hulk, a plague ship, a death ship. Something is waiting for him there, something in a shroud. And he would scream if he could, but now the water fills his eyes and there are other hands, ones that feel like nothing but stripped radiations of bone. Closing around his ankles. A talon pulls off a shoe, then tweaks a toe, as if it means to play this little piggy went to market with him as he drowns. As Emery Paulson drowns. April of 27. 1. Someone was yelling in the dark. It sounded like, make him stop screaming. Then there was a flat, hard whacking sound, and the dark lit up deep red, first on one side, then in the back. The red rolled toward the front of the darkness like a cloud of blood and water. You hit him too hard, someone said. Was that Jack? Boss! Hey, boss! Someone was shaking me, so I still had a body. Probably that was good. Jack was shaking me. Jack who? I could get it, but I had to think sideways. His name was like someone on the Weather Channel. More shaking, rougher. Muchacho, you there?